This is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and we hope you've signed in to our Planet FM 104.6 Mental Health Show. I'm Sheldon Brown, and that was Rita Murdoch's Many Lines. I'm the host of Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and we are funded by Framework. Now, just how stressed are Kiwis? What is stressing them out, and how much is work tying them down? And even when we take a break away from work, it seems that more than three quarters of us can't ditch the office and regard work as just a part of everyday life, even when we are on holiday. These are the findings from a 2017 New Zealand research report commissioned by a major hotel chain, Choice Hotels Asia Pacific, to understand how interested Kiwis are in short breaks to address their stress and what are the barriers for Kiwis taking short breaks. You may wonder how we've accessed this research by Choice Hotels Asia Pacific, and we're going to explain that. Our guest Vicky Baird is going to explain how she got involved with this research commissioned by Choice Hotels. So here to discuss the findings of this research is our counselling psychologist Vicky Baird. Welcome back, Vicky, to Take It From Us. It's been a few months.
Thank you, Sheldon. It's nice to be back after a short break myself.
Except probably not a short break sitting on the beach in Fiji.
Unfortunately not.
Or sitting on the beach in Pihar. I noticed you on Facebook enjoying Pihar. So
that was my short break, yeah.
Short break. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in these short breaks because nowhere does the research actually talk about how long a short break is, unless I've missed it somewhere.
Oh, I believe there was, yeah. I think it was between 1 and 3 days away.
Right. So. Well, let's get into this research. I mean, firstly, how did you come to access this research by Choice Hotels Asia Pacific?
I was approached as part of, I was approached by a media company who were distributing the research out on behalf of Choice Hotels. So they were looking for an advocate or someone who could speak from a psychological perspective. I didn't end up being part of that work opportunity for various reasons. However, as you and I were talking about it, we both felt that, you know, the research would be interesting to share. It had some interesting points.
Yeah, well, it definitely has some great insights into the level of stress in New Zealand society. So what does this research say about the stress levels of New Zealanders?
So overall, in general terms, it reported... actually, before we get into that, just to give a context. So this was an online survey that was carried out in March this year. So it surveyed 1,002 Kiwis over 18 years old who were living in households earning a minimum amount of $50,000 per year. So this is online research. It was a basic survey format. And what it came up with in general was that 65% of those people surveyed reported some level of stress. So 53% of them were what you would call moderately stressed, and 12% were very stressed. So that's over half the population who had significant levels of stress.
Does that finding surprise you? I mean, that's actually 67% that are moderately or fairly intensively stressed.
65%. 65. Yeah, it doesn't actually surprise me because what I do notice, so when I'm doing adult mindfulness groups in the community, we take statistics as well, and about 80% of the people that come along to those groups come because of stress, you know, stress levels for some reason. So the statistics themselves didn't really surprise me.
I mean, I got that revelation when I went to one of your mindfulness works course, but it was a mindfulness works in Mount Eden. I think you do them out west.
Yeah.
And when the facilitator asked why people were there, there was a very large majority of the people attending who were young mothers who said they were very, very stressed. They were unable to focus on what their children were doing, what their children were saying to them, and they recognised that they just weren't present for their children particularly. I guess that was a major reflection of stress.
Yeah, that's it, you know, and that touches on the point that was the other finding in this report, you know, that the significant causes of stress for people, the top three are work, finances and family issues. Those are the top three things.
Right. Among men and women, excuse me, who are the most stressed in our society?
Take a guess, guys, out there. What do you
right.
think?
Living with us men makes it very stressful.
No comment on that. 71% of women, I'll let the statistics do the talking, 71% of women are stressed and 60% of men, according to this research. So obviously, quite a significant higher amount of women, although the statistics are still very high for both sexes.
So any revelations about why women present as appearing to be more stressed? I mean, perhaps they are just more emotionally intelligent and are prepared to be honest about it, open about it, admit to it, whereas us guys hide it away.
A fair comment. Yeah, I do think that's probably one of the factors in there. Like, although the research report doesn't go into details around that, it just looks at the plain statistics. From my perspective as a counselling psychologist, working with adults, I think there's a lot to do with with how men and women measure or connect to their stress. Women, it's often easier for women to admit they're stressed. Society looks on that more fairly, whereas men, you know, there's that kind of harden up, get on with it mentality. So there is that. I also think that, yeah, as you said, Sheldon, women tend to be a bit more in touch with their emotions, so they can see when they're stressed, whereas men might not be able to see it so well. The other factor that I think comes into this, and what I often see, particularly in individual work with adults, is that often women in a relationship, in a marriage, women tend to be the holders of the emotion, you know, and that's because, you know, that's because often men have grown up, you know, we've grown up in a society where we haven't got much intelligence around emotional intelligence. There's not much out there to teach people, and particularly for men. So often the feelings or the emotions that the men are dismissing or pushing away in themselves, the women in the relationship can pick that up and tend to be the ones that then hold that anxiety and hold that stress.
Right.
So I think that's got a lot to do with it as well.
There's a classic example on the latest Toyota advertisement of how Kiwi men manage their stresses. And, you know, this guy picks his mate up, and he's the guy picking his mate up is aware that, you know, things aren't too bright and that sort of thing. Takes him for breakfast, and then they go out in the outback in this Toyota ute, and, you know, they go fishing and they get into the mud and that sort of thing. And on the way back, the guy who has clearly got an issue sort of puts his head on his mate's shoulder, you know, as much as to say, well, thanks, mate, you've really helped my stress. But at no stage do they talk about what is worrying this guy, you know.
Wow.
And as he leaves the ute, he says, great chat, mate. and they haven't said a thing, you know. It's a real reinforcing of the stereotype that when guys get together, you know, even when there's a recognition that there's an issue, they don't talk about it.
Wow, that's great. Yep, that sums it up really well, eh?
I'm very tempted to write to Toyota and say that they are reinforcing the stereotypes. But
that's true too,
So what? I think you've already given us a bit of an insight into what Kiwis agree is the best way to relieve their stress.
Yeah, well, what's interesting in this report, I think we have to mention, so this was obviously some questions were kind of multiple choice report. So what came up was that 44% of the people surveyed agreed that short breaks were one of the main keys to relieve their stress. I mean, the choices they got within that were, so the choices were short break, sleep, exercise, sex, a bath, food, alcohol and shopping. So those were the choices they got. So this is 44% out of those choices that chose short break.
And do you think those options were realistic stress-busting options? I guess they are, aren't they? A hot bath, maybe sex?
Yeah, I believe so. I think the one thing that's missing from there, which I might have put in, would be something around psychological tools, counselling or talking to people, you know, or even mindfulness, So
like talking to a friend.
Yeah. So that's things that were missing out of that list that you could say may have made a significant change. However, you know, it's interesting what you, in light of what you just talked about, Sheldon, you know, that short break is up there, you know, because that is, you know, particularly in this culture, in the Kiwi culture, there is so much, you know, culture around getting away, you know, going to the batch, getting away from things.
That is a tradition, and that's one of the things that I had in mind when I read this research, because the research actually says that most Kiwis only take two short breaks a year. They'd like to take more. I think they'd all like all different age groups, the millennials, the baby boomers, the others, they'd all like to take at least four short breaks. But what is it that constrains them from taking those breaks?
So according to this report, the main constraints are work and finances. Those are the top two. So work was up there as number one, but finances were very close second.
Well, they're very closely tied together, aren't they?
Exactly, I mean,
if you're dependent on money from your work, then the things are just inextricably linked, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. So that's the thing that we don't really know from the report. Like, we don't know how those two work together. We don't know what elements of work hold people back. You know, is it a reluctance to leave work, at home, or is it more tied in with that financial thing? We're not quite sure, but we can make some educated guesses.
But the research actually suggests that even when people take short breaks, what happens, Vicky?
Oh, yeah, what happens is that 40% of Kiwis in this survey stay connected to work in some way.
So even when they're on holiday, when they're taking a short break, and they've taken that break probably because they've recognised their stress, which probably mostly comes from work.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I mean, obviously, there'll be a small amount of people within that 40% who might need to stay connected in some reason, but that doesn't count for all. I'm sure that there's a lot of people there that are just staying connected because they feel obliged to, or they accept it as part of the culture or whatever. The other interesting statistic was that within that, they also asked people, you know, if they felt any guilt or if they just accepted that staying connected to work was okay. And it was very high. It was 76% felt no guilt about staying connected to work and actually accepted it as part of everyday life. So that's quite high.
You've taken your family away, you've taken your children away on the short break, your wife, and yet you're on the cell phone or you're on the iPad checking the emails, and there's no guilt associated with that. You know, how do you feel about that finding? Do you find that surprising?
I guess in one way I'm not so surprised when I actually observe, you know, the culture of our society. But in another way it is surprising. I mean, 76% of people accepting that this is just the way things are. I think that's shocking, you know, and I think that highlights something that's, you know, fundamentally wrong in our society. I think there's a huge expectation now, particularly now with, like, you know, emails, smartphones, social media, you know, there's this expectation that people are always available.
That they're available 24/7.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're wanting to take a short break. They're recognising that a short break is the way to bust their stress.
Mm.
And yet they're undermining the benefit of that short break, aren't they?
Mm.
By staying connected with work.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. So that statistic's interesting, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's come back and talk a little bit more about this research on what is stressing Kiwis. We're playing The Commitments today, and our first track is one of their classics, Mustang Sally.
You better slow up that Mustang down. Mustang Sally, my baby. Guess you better slow up that Mustang down. You've been running. You wanna do is ride around, Sally.
That's a commitments classic, Mustang Sally on Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, and we're talking to counselling psychologist Vicky Beard. It's great to have Vicky back in the studio, and she was involved in some research on Kiwi stress levels, which was commissioned by a major hotel chain, Choice Hotels Asia Pacific. Vicky was approached to be an ambassador or a champion of short breaks. Obviously, that's what Choice Hotels were hoping would come out of this research. So we got access to it. Let's just reiterate, Vicky, what is sort of stressing Kiwis? What are the major issues? And in fact, I understand from the research there's only about 7% of Kiwis that say they feel no stress at all.
Yeah, that's right. So the criteria which people were asked, so they were asked to rate themselves in terms of one, either no stress at all, the next one up was not very stressed, and next one was moderately stressed, and the highest was very stressed. So there was 7% said no stress at all, which is great, because I don't encounter many people that say they have no stress at all, but they're obviously out there. 28% were not very stressed, so that's not too significant. I mean, that probably just means that it was the average stresses of daily life. But definitely the figures that are most interesting are the fact that over half the people surveyed were moderately stressed, and 12% were very stressed. So that's half the people who were, you know, getting on that, you know, moderate to very stressed level.
So let's reinforce what are the major issues that are stressing Kiwis at the moment.
Yeah, so the first one was work. So 62% of people rated work as being their main cause of stress, or major cause of stress. Next after that was finances or money. So that was 57%. So both of those were quite high. So work 62, finances, money 57%. The next one on the list was family issues, and that came in at 36%. So about a third.
Right. So there are other things that are less stressful, cause less stress in Kiwis' lives. Mm. What are some of the things that were detailed in the research?
So within that context, so there was work, finances, money and family issues. Those were the top three. The other options that were in the survey were illness. So 22% of people rated illness as being one of the causes of stress, which makes sense as well. Interestingly enough, household chores was up there, quite significant, 20%. Children, 19%. Kind of interesting. I would have thought that maybe children would have been more, just going from the observations and what you said earlier, Sheldon, that, you know, many adults come along to the mindfulness groups via mindfulness works because of, you know, how to parent, how to, you know, look after their children. Interestingly enough, 15% also noted society expectations as being a cause of stress. And what was interesting about that was, because they surveyed, so they broke the population up into, so the millennials, so that kind of leaving school, going into the early 20s, what's the next one up? I can't remember. The Generation X, I always forget that. So that's the kind of 30s, 40s. And then the baby boomers, you know, so going 50s.
So the things that stressed those three different parts of society were different, weren't they?
They were different. However, work and finances and money were top for across the board. Yeah. Things like, for instance, social expectations was quite high in the millennials. So that was like 24%, whereas in the Generation X or baby boomers, that did not come in.
Right.
Kind of makes sense, you know. Obviously, children were a bit higher in the Generation X sample, so children were 27% of the stress.
Yeah. I mean, work is a very general, it's a generic term. Mm. As a psychologist, do you have any insights in what are some of the things specifically within that big category of work that are stressing people out?
That's a good question, Sheldon, because, I mean, that's something that obviously the research doesn't go into, and it will be interesting to do a bit more research around that. You know, what is it? Is it, you know, for some people it may be lack of work, you know, not getting enough work, you know. Particularly, you know, in New Zealand there's a lot of people that are self-employed as well, you know, so that plays a big factor. If you're self-employed, you know, how do your short break habits change? What are the barriers?
Well, I think you're much more restricted in being able to take a short break, because if you're a sole operator, then you have to be there to service the business and service the clients.
Which could play into that factor, you know, that statistic we looked at around people taking work with them, you know. So there's all these kind of different factors. From my observations working with adults, I know one of the main causes of stress at work seems to be the culture that we're in now in society. Organisations are just increasingly, you know, there's less and less money and people are expected to be doing more and more with their time and their energy.
Well, the health sector and the mental health sector specifically, I think, is known for that now, isn't it? There's no extra money to fund services. All those of us that are working in mental health are required to do more for the same money.
And that's it. And it's not just mental health, you know, it's across the board. You know, that's what adults come into time and time again. They come into my mindfulness groups, and those are the kind of things that are coming up, you know. It's just more and more expectations placed on people. So I think that has got a significant factor to do with this.
I mean, lack of work or being on the benefit, that's not a category that has been included in this research.
Yeah, well, we don't know how people have rated this. You know, it's been an online research. So for someone who's struggling to get work, they might have rated themselves as work being a major stress. That's what we don't know. We don't know how people have interpreted these.
And then I guess there's all the things like relationships at work, relationships with our managers, bullying, just the pressure of achieving goals, I guess, achieving targets. You know, if we're a salesperson and we've done well one particular month, then there's an expectation that we're going to have to do well every month and better that target.
Yeah.
These are all the pressures that cause work to be the big stress issue in our society.
Yeah, I mean, it's real interesting. There's so many complex issues around work. And again, I mean, it makes sense in a way, because work, you know, work is a main part of our life. You know, it's a mainstay for most people in their life. So it makes sense that there's going to be stressors there.
Yeah.
It's going to be significant. I mean, it's interesting that work is, you know, 62% people. So 62% people rate that being the main cause of stress, whereas family issues are half of that, or just over half of that, at 36%, and you would expect that they would probably be up there too, because that's the other main part of our lives.
You know, we've got this statistic which shows that women are more stressed than men. I mean, I suspect that women are more stressed because they take so much more of the responsibility of family, of collecting the children from daycare, or having to organise the grandparents to fill the gap before mum gets home or dad gets home, you know. I mean, really, unfortunately, in New Zealand, the owner falls, the responsibilities fall on women for the family, I think.
Yeah, and that's true, Sheldon, and that reflects in the results that women definitely rated family issues as being higher a higher cause of stress. Work was still up there. It was the main cause of stress for women, but family issues were up there for women as well. For instance, women in comparison to men, so 42% of women rated family issues as being a main cause of stress, whereas 30% of men did.
Right.
So,
right.
So it makes sense that
they are
family.
Insulated a little bit from the family issues often, aren't they? I mean, men, I guess. I'm being very general here, but perhaps men come home later from work, women have to take that responsibility, they have to look after the domestic side of things. It's an unfortunate separation of responsibilities, I suppose. I'd like to think there was more equality, you know, and more men cooking and more men taking on some of the family responsibilities.
However, on the other hand, you know, much more men are stressed about work and finances. So, you know, they're up there, like 69% of men are stressed about work versus 56% of women. So,
right. So men are possibly, you know, still in that role of being the provider and feeling the stress of perhaps the sole breadwinner, the sole salary earner, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so that makes a natural, you know, I think that just naturally reflects what's happening still in society. However, that's changing, I think. That balance is changing.
Well, so, let's hope so. Yeah. Men are taking more responsibility in the kitchen. let's play some more commitments. And our next track is called Chain of Fools.
Chain, chain, chain. Thank you.
Well, that's Chain of Fools by The Commitments, and guest Vicky Baird was very excited when I said I was playing The Commitments as one of your favourites, Vicky.
Yeah, it was a little blast from the past.
Well, they even had a movie, didn't they? The Commitments movie, and that was a pretty great insight into how The Commitments formed and became successful.
They did, yeah. I was pretty young when that movie came out, but my older brother loved it.
Yeah, right. Well, we're talking to Vicky, resident psychologist, about this research, why Kiwis are stressed, what is stressing them out, and how much is work tying them down. And the research commissioned by Choice Hotels Asia Pacific suggests that we may have work a little bit out of proportion, out of kilter, Vicky.
Mm, yeah, work seems to be the main relationship in people's life, so. Yeah.
And is that healthy, do you think? I mean, it does sound as though there's a little bit of an imbalance here.
It certainly does. I'd like to see that balance being a bit lowered. You know, it'd be nice to think that people have a more of a work-life balance, but... Yep.
But essentially, I mean, it's my belief that this is a reflection of the fact that costs are going up, rents are going up, mortgages are a huge sort of albatross around people's necks these days. If you want to get into the new Auckland market particularly, or any housing market in New Zealand, you've got to borrow $500,000 or $600,000 unless you're in a very privileged position or have got rich parents. So that's got to be serviced every week, doesn't it? Or if you're paying anywhere between $600 and $800 in rent, and I've got a couple living across the courtyard from me that are paying $700, parents with one child, I mean, that's a huge drain, and it's a constant amount of money that is just going out every week.
Yeah, that's true, Sheldon. You know, I think the climate, particularly in Auckland, it's such a huge responsibility for people. So it makes sense that work and finances are up there as the main concern for people.
I mean, I was shopping the other day. I couldn't buy a small quantity of honey less than $10. You know, and what's happened to the price of butter in the last, you know, 3 months or so? I mean, these are things that worry superannuitants like me.
Yeah, that's true. I think it worries everyone, you know. And it's just a reflection that the cost of living is going up, and wages aren't going up as fast, you know. So there is an imbalance there.
Well, I had a pay rise the other day, which really surprised me. It might be the last pay rise that I get in my whole career, because I guess it's coming to an end sooner rather than later. But that was a nice little surprise. But anyway,
you can afford to take another short break.
I can, definitely. I'll be able to drive down to Wongamatar or something. Just looking at what are the preferred options stress busting, what are the stress busting solutions?
So again, we touched on this earlier. So the options that people were given in the survey were short break, sleep, exercise, sex, a bath, food, alcohol and shopping. So those were options that people were given. Not surprisingly, most people pick short break. So that was up there at 44%. However, what I find surprising was that alcohol was down at 3%. So sex was up there at 11%. More people preferred sex to alcohol to relieve stress. Sleep and exercise were up there, 15% and 14%. But yeah, that figure on alcohol, it surprised me, and it didn't surprise me, I guess. It surprised me in the sense that what we know about New Zealand culture, there is a big drinking culture, and there's a lot of people that use alcohol to manage their stress levels. So it surprised me that it was so low, to be honest, in this particular survey. However, not surprising in the fact that often people don't admit to using alcohol to help them manage their emotions or stress. So, yeah, I just thought that was...
Continuing on that subject of alcohol, I mean, how good is alcohol as a stress manager?
Well, obviously in the long term, it's not good. And if you use it too high an amount, it's not going to be good. You could argue that a little bit, you know, on a moderate level can definitely help. It can help to take an edge off a day. It can help to add, you know, a bit more lightness and, you know, refreshment on a social occasion. But obviously as a long term or as a main coping mechanism, it's not great. Yeah.
I guess it's like our psychiatric medication is sort of putting a blanket on it, isn't it? It's sort of delaying addressing those things that are really stressing us.
Exactly. It's delaying it. And then, you know, if people begin using it significantly on a long-term basis, it can have an impact on, you know, our brain chemistry, our emotions, our mood. So, yeah, it's not ideal.
Well, alcohol is a depressant,
yeah.
So if we're feeling stressed, we're possibly our mood is dropping a little bit. Mm. Alcohol not always the best answer.
That's it. Interestingly enough, though, it's interesting, you know, I hear particularly, I guess, a lot of the younger Kiwis or the younger people in society who go away, they go away on short breaks too to drink, you know. So, you know, it's just interesting when you start to look at that, you know, at what. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things about they're advocating short breaks, but these breaks are only sort of 1 to 3 days. I mean, if we are really stressed and we need to recuperate from a psychological point of view, is 1 or 3 days long enough to get a benefit?
Yeah, well, you could argue that having a few short breaks in a year is very beneficial as opposed to having none or waiting for a whole year to, say, get 1 week. However, in saying that, we definitely need longer periods of time as well. You know, I don't think that going away just for 1 or 2 days is really enough. It is good to be able to switch off at least once a year for a significant period of 1 or 2 weeks.
And they do say that short breaks are the top benefit in making us feel happier and less stressed, don't they? So,
well, what they looked at, they didn't necessarily say it was the top benefit, but what they looked at was the benefits to short breaks. So what did people rate as the benefits to short breaks? And the things that they said was, one, it's easier to plan and longer holidays, which makes sense, you know, and I think that is a real benefit and you know, can help to alleviate stress. The other things that people said was it helps them restore a sense of balance to their lives and to feel revitalised after they've been away, so it helps them to get back into their daily life. And about one third of people said they felt a closer connection to their families after taking a short break. So yeah, there's definitely heaps of benefits to taking short breaks.
I mean, psychologically, is there any sort of formula as to how many short breaks we should take in a year that we should get away from it, chill out?
Well, to my knowledge, there's been no research done specifically around that. What this research says that most people take, most people in this survey took about 2 short breaks a year on average. But what people did say is they would like to take more, up to 4 or even 6 short breaks a year. And, you know, intuitively saying, I think that would make sense, you know. I think it makes sense to have more regular breaks more often. as opposed to going for long periods of time without a break.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things I thought about was that when we get a long weekend, you know, everybody leaves town, and it does seem as though there's quite a large proportion of people that are taking breaks, you know. Over Easter, we had a situation, I think, if you only had to take 3 days annual leave, what was it, between Easter and Anzac Day or something like that, or Queen's Birthday weekend, and you could end up with 10 days break, which is almost like a annual holiday, a major significant annual holiday. I mean, we are in a privileged position in New Zealand that we have normally 3 to 4 weeks holiday. I find get guests coming to stay with me from America, and they only have 2 weeks.
I think
the Chinese probably only get about 10 days leave. So most of the Chinese who come to New Zealand, they have to do the whole of New Zealand in 10 days and be back to work.
We're in a
privileged position at the generosity of annual leave that we get. But I wonder if there are a lot of people that aren't taking their allocation because they're committed to work, they want to be there, they don't want to have their job threatened.
Good comment, Sheldon, there. And it will be interesting to look at that. That's why I think it will be real interesting, to do a bit more research around that. You know, what exactly are the barriers around that work?
Let's take our last track from The Commitments. This has got a lovely title called Try a Little Tenderness.
Young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old shaggy dress. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness. Just anticipating the things that she never, 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 never possesses yet. But while she's there waiting without them, try a little tenderness. That's all you gotta do. It's not just sentimental, no, no. She has her grief and her care. But soft words, they all spoke so gentle. It makes it easier. Regret it, no, no. Young girls, they never forget it. Love is their only happiness. But it is so easy. All you gotta do. We'll be right back.
Well, let's try a little tenderness from the Commitments on Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. I think that's a nice little tip that we could try a little tenderness with our friends, with our partners, our wives or husbands, try a little tenderness, and I'm sure that it would reap considerable benefits. Well, we were talking to Vicky Baird about this research as to why New Zealanders, Kiwis are stressed and what is stressing them out. One of the issues that has been very top of mind, particularly via the Herald, is their series called Break the Silence about youth suicide. And I've got another editorial that I'd like to read, which refers to child and adolescent mental health services. It says we need to deal with our terrible statistics. The child and adolescent mental health crisis demands urgency. One of the disturbing facts to emerge from our series on youth suicide came from the Ministry of Health data on referrals to the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. Documents released to the Herald under the Official Information Act showed that 32,064 children and teenagers were referred to the service last year. That's to the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. That is about 90 young New Zealanders a day, 90 young New Zealanders a day, or close to the population of the west coast of the South Island. The total of referrals has grown by nearly 6,000 since 2012. The service, which provides consultation, assessment and treatment, only deals with those most unwell. It operates on the assumption that services below this acute level run effectively, when clearly they do not. According to parents and teachers interviewed as part of our series, Break the Silence, the service can be difficult to access. More than 32,000 were referred last year, some 1,824 children and teenagers were turned down. Distressed parents who contacted us complained that they could only get their children seen by service professionals if their sons or daughters had a plan to kill themselves. Officials rejected this extraordinary assertion on the grounds that Ministry of Health policy required that people in crisis needed to be seen within 48 hours. But even those not assessed as urgent are forced to wait weeks to get help. Some 753 children aged 11 and under had to wait more than 2 months for a non-urgent mental health assessment last year. Parents have told us they are at their wits' end. Principals are just as frustrated. Pat Newman, the head of Te Tai Tokerau Principals Association, says he is contemplating advising the 150 northern schools in the group to expel all pupils with severe behavioural problems. It is an extreme response to a desperate problem, but Newman says that despite fighting, he is not succeeding in getting help for children. An educator for 40 years, Newman says he has seen suicide issues shift from adults to teenagers to primary pupils. The evidence presented during our series shows the current policy is failing because, as is abundantly clear, New Zealand has a crisis with adolescent mental health. It is worth stating again that New Zealand has the second worst suicide rate among those aged 25 and under in the developed world. Our teen suicide rate, officially those aged 15 to 19, is the worst. By any measure, these are awful statistics and demand a clear, immediate and brave response. It was heartening to hear Dr. Ian Soucy, the Ministry's Deputy Director of Mental Health, say there was a sense of urgency around the issue. Susay, a psychiatrist, accepts that New Zealand has not done enough to help children with mental health problems and that different thinking is required. This year's budget set aside an additional $224 million for mental health services over the next 4 years. About $25 million a year will go towards, quote, innovative, unquote, proposals to tackle mental health issues. A lot of parents and principals would like to hear from Health Minister Jonathan Coleman exactly how this money will be invested in repairing the system and provide some comfort to families struggling with their children. This issue has not surfaced overnight. It has long warranted a call to arms. Coleman needs sooner rather than later to explain to families and schools what exactly is coming from the sense of urgency that one of his senior officials says now surrounds the country's terrible state of child mental health. That's an editorial from the Herald last Saturday. It's about the child and adolescent mental health crisis, which the Herald says demands urgency. And I just finish with my own personal comment that as an ex-journalist and broadcaster, I'm appalled that the Minister of Health, Jonathan Coleman, is nowhere to be seen in this series, Break the Silence, by the Herald, being published by the Herald over several weeks. Jonathan Coleman has disappeared. He's dodging any of these serious questions about youth mental health and youth suicide. I think it's appalling that he is leaving the responsibility to executives and officials of the Ministry of Health. And I think that if Jonathan Coleman wants to be re-elected, that he needs to front what is a serious deficiency in our youth mental health services, not only in our youth mental health services, but obviously in our adult mental health services. What I cannot condone is that when people are in crisis, they need help, and they need help within 24 or 48 hours. They cannot be left to wait for weeks and weeks and weeks. And that's something that I have campaigned for, is a shorter period of time for people in crisis to get help. That's taken from us, Mental Health Radio on Planet FM 104.6. Thank you for listening. I'm Sheldon Brown, host of Take It From Us, and look forward to you being back to listen with us next week.